any damage to Bidafin.
Any new pharmaceutical drug, Bidafin.
Bidafin.
That's actually great.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we've got a lot to discuss today. Democratic primary voters have had a few days to process the debates, so we're going to see how their views have evolved since we last convened late Thursday night. We're also going to double back to something else that happened on Thursday, the Supreme Court's ruling on partisan gerrymandering. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said that partisan gerrymandering is a political issue and not up for the courts to decide. So what exactly does that mean for the next round of redistricting and efforts to curb gerrymandering? We're also going to discuss the latest sexual assault accusation against the president. Author E. Jean Carroll has said that Trump raped her in a dressing room in the 1990s. The accusation got limited attention from the press, including us. So we're going to talk about why that is and what effects sexual assault accusations have had on the president. Here with me to do all of that, our senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How's it going?
It's good, Galen.
And managing editor, Micah Cohen. How are you?
I'm good.
Nate Silver is out today. He is playing poker in Las Vegas. So hope you're
classic
winning some money, I guess. Anyway, we've got a lot to talk about. So let's begin with the debates. For starters, do we have a better idea now of who won the debates in voters' minds?
Yes, we do have a better idea of things. We had the novel idea, not me, someone smarter than me.
It was all Claire's idea.
It's all me, folks. No, I believe this was spearheaded by Julia Wolf.
And Aaron Bykoff.
And Aaron Bykoff. To actually do a tracking poll of voters before and after the debates to sort of track favorabilities of candidates and try to give us a better rubric by which to judge debate performance rather than just our own gut opinions. And we now have some pretty interesting data. I am looking at a chart here of net favorabilities. So it's showing whose prospects improved with voters most and least after the debates. And coming in at the very top with a plus 15.5 net favorability change is Julian Castro.
Interesting.
Yeah. Followed by Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Tulsi Gabbard.
So just to be clear, that means Castro's net favorability, so that's the share who think well of you minus the share who think poorly of you, went up by basically 16 points. He went from plus 20 to plus 35. That's a huge change.
It's huge. And I think let's butter our own bread here or pat ourselves on the back. I don't know.
Claire.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Let's cut
not
that.
In public, Claire.
Let's pat ourselves. I don't know why I said that.
I also don't know that that has... Does it have the meaning that I think it does?
I don't know. I just fucking said it. I'm starting this over.
No, you're not. We're definitely keeping this in.
My mom listens to this sometimes. Let's not talk about that.
Okay.
Well, I think we should pat ourselves on the back because I actually think our reactions after the debate and during the live blogs kind of captured that. Like, first night, Julian Castro was A, introducing himself to people, because a lot of people don't know who he was. B, he was sort of going after candidates, notably Beto O'Rourke. And C, he was coming off as policy proficient. I think we should also note that the people who fared the worst favorability-wise from our tracking poll, Beto O'Rourke saw a negative 11.6 change. Marianne Williamson saw a negative 9.1 change in favorabilities. And Joe Biden saw a negative 5.6 change in favorability.
So I think for people who heard our reactions to the debate, watched the debates, maybe thinking, well, oh, in my mind, you know, Kamala Harris won the debates or Elizabeth Warren won the debates. So here we're talking about change in favorability. But when we're talking about how people changed their preference for first place, who they planned on, you know, voting for, what did we learn there?
Yeah. So a couple things. One is there's a reason we led with favorability there. I do think that's important. If you look at the horse race, there's much less change, but I think that makes sense, right? Voters are sort of less willing to switch a candidate wholesale, but these kind of general impressions of the candidates, I almost think are kind of more meaningful at this stage.
Why is that? Because the race is so wide open and
it's just the race is very fluid. We'll have a lot more debates. And so it's sort of like who voters are considering voting for as judged through favorability is sort of like, to me, the thing to watch this early in the campaign, as opposed to, you know, does Warren have 10% support in vote choice versus 15%? I'm not sure it's like the biggest deal in the world. And then so you look at favorability, Beto's drop, minus 12 points. That's like a big drop. We'll see if it sticks, right? That's a big caveat I would put on all of this is like, this is just one poll. We'll have to wait and see if there's more polling that confirms it. I'd expect to see some of these changes kind of revert to the mean, or, you know, as the debate fades in memory. Anyway, if you look at who voters said they were going to vote for, there's really only one big change, and it's two sides of the same coin. And that is Harris gained, Biden dropped.
Right.
So Biden dropped 8 points in first choice vote support from before the debates, both debates, to after. So he went from 36% to 28%. That 8-point drop is actually a little bit less than it was right after the second debate. I think it was a 10-point drop as of like Friday evening. And so I think you're already maybe seeing a little bit of a reversion to the mean. And then Harris gained 9 points, going from 7% to 16%.
You sort of saw a shuffle of the top four contenders, basically. So it's been Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris. And after the debate, Harris and Warren flip spots. So Harris is now in third and Warren is fourth.
I think
they're going in the horse race.
I think that's right. And then also just like, more generally, I think both Warren and Harris closed the gap on Biden and Sanders, both in like a literal sense and the data, but also just like
Sanders stayed completely flatline neutral in polling changes. There was no change in who placed him as their number one vote choice.
Which plays into something that we've talked about on this podcast, which is that he has a very enthusiastic base of support. Questionable how much room he has to gain or lose on either side of that. Beyond the kind of like headline names coming out of the debates, did anybody else create an opening for themselves? We talked about Julian Castro's favorability improving right after the second debate. We talked about, you know, Pete Buttigieg potentially having a good performance. Did any of that show up in the polling?
I mean, Buttigieg, his net favorability improved a little bit by, you know, 2 or 3 points. He didn't really move in the horse race polling. I think he dropped like a point, but that's, you know, within the margin of error. So I don't think the debates really moved things for Buttigieg one way or the other. I guess what I'd say is, outside of Warren, Harris, Biden, Sanders, I think really the only clear winner was Castro, maybe Booker. His favorability improved a bit. You could probably say Klobuchar. Not because her numbers improved all that much, but just I figure as someone sort of running in that more moderate lane, any damage to Biden, I think, redounds to her benefit, at least theoretically. Whether she can capitalize on that remains to be seen. The only other thing I would add about these numbers is, as Claire said earlier, I think our impressions of the debate, and look, the media's impressions generally, I don't think we were like out on a limb here, were largely backed up in the data. Now, there's a chicken or egg question in there, right? Because the media obviously affects how voters are responding to the debate. The one thing in the data that I think did make me adjust my impressions from the debate a little bit was I really came out of it thinking Castro was the clear winner in the early numbers on night one. Warren did fine. And then Harris was the big winner on night two. But if you look at the favorability numbers, Warren's numbers actually went up a lot, you know, 11 points from basically plus 50 before the debate to plus 61 after. That's like right up there with Castro, and I think suggests voters liked what they saw from her in that first debate.
I'm so glad we did this project. I had nothing to do with it, and I'd just like to say I think it's like a really good thing.
Round of applause for Julian Aaron. Morning Consult.
Laura, Sarah Frostenson, lots of people. Colleen Barry, one of our copy editors, lots of people were involved in this.
So we highlighted who the winners were. Is it clear who the loser was? Is it Biden and Beto? Anybody else?
I think Biden, Beto, and all the other low-level candidates who didn't break through.
Yeah, I mean, like, you see Michael Bennett, Andrew Yang, Jay Inslee, Eric Swalwell, Tim Ryan, John Hickenlooper, John Eleni. All those people saw negative net favorabilities. So those are the kind of slew of, to the general public, probably undifferentiated, largely white guys. And they did not do much, it would appear, from these numbers to differentiate themselves.
Yeah.
Or they differentiated themselves
in a slightly
negative way.
But it's like, it's all well and good for Bernie not to make a lot of progress via this debate, because he's doing pretty well. Now, I think we talked about this on an earlier pod, but you still sort of wonder, like, okay, Bernie, you still have to get from here to there. You're not doing well enough to win the nomination right now. So, like, what's your strategy to add voters to your coalition? But still, it's one thing for Bernie to, like, stay at wherever he is in the polls. For all those other candidates, even staying still, put aside, like, going down, even staying still is sort of really bad.
Like, it's like, what did you prove to us about your viability, or like, what do you add to this race? I should note, shout out Bill de Blasio for having a 0.4 net favorability gain.
He
is in the black.
Although we should be clear, he's not in the black yet. He went from, first of all, he's the only Democrat with a net negative net favorability rating. And he went from negative 2.1 to negative 1.6. So he's still not break even yet. But he did gain 0.4 percentage points.
You alluded to this earlier, Micah, but how significant are these changes in the long term? Like, when we've had past debates, how enduring are their effects on the horse race?
They tend to be real but fading, which is why I said we should expect some reversion to the mean in the numbers. I also just want to see other polling to see how much of this is reflected in other data. But like,
it's like convention bumps.
Yeah, it's a little like convention bumps. I guess the exception, though, is like this being the first debate, it's not just like, oh, Castro improved his net favorability by 16 points, or that Harris gained, you know, 9 points in the horse race. It's more like, oh, Castro, Warren, Harris, they were really good debaters. Maybe that was a fluke, but there are going to be a lot more debates until we learn something about the campaigns. Biden had a really tough time. Sure. Well, if that holds true, then I think it's like, both, does this data stick? And even if it doesn't, do the dynamics we saw on stage last week stick? That could be much more meaningful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, to me, someone like Castro has the most to gain from this, because, I mean, I think people who have been watching the election so far were not surprised that Harris did well, per se, right? Even though she's had, like, oh, the campaign relaunch and all that stuff, it's always been a pretty, like, snappy operation, as is she, right? She's kind of like a sharp person. But someone like Castro, who's been sort of wandering a little bit in the wilderness of the national media isn't paying attention to me, has the real potential to make this into a lasting bump, because it probably means that assigning editors are going to assign stories about Julian Castro, right? And like, that's going to be good for him. I mean, in some ways, like, you could compare it to the sort of like Buttigieg bounty of media stories a couple months back, where people were kind of like, oh, who's this guy? Like, let's write stories about him. And like, perhaps that happens to Castro post debate. So that's a way for campaigns to capitalize on, oh, people saw us in the debates, we got a bump, now how do we run that forward?
There's like a self-perpetuating nature to this. Yeah.
Wrapping up here, did we learn anything about the party in terms of perhaps policy positions, where the party is going in that divide between the left and center? What did we learn about the Democratic Party from the first two nights of debate?
I think we learned that we're going to keep talking about the divides over how people's healthcare plans spool out, right? You know, I think you saw someone like Amy Klobuchar comes to mind as the person who was sort of saying, listen, I'd love to do this, but I don't think that Medicare for All works, and I don't want to lie to you, right? That was essentially the gist of her line. So healthcare, I think, is going to continue to be a bone of contention. You know, it's interesting. The Biden-Harris blow-up over race was obviously the central point of the debate in many ways. And I've been thinking to myself, if Biden, like, let's say 8 months from now, very, very hypothetical, like, what if Biden drops out? Will race still be a focal point of the election, or will it sort of be transferred to, like, the immigration debate, and that's how we'll talk about racism in America or racial justice. Like, in some ways, that debate over busing, while American schools are still segregated and American neighborhoods are still segregated, and actually Elizabeth Warren has a housing plan that's sort of meant to restore black homeowner wealth, I'm not sure that without Biden it becomes a sort of super central theme, even though we're talking about reparations and all that stuff. But it doesn't, that doesn't seem like a thing that the Democratic Party wants to bring front and center to their primary. So I'm kind of, healthcare for sure, immigration for sure. If Biden stays in the race, I think we'll continue to see these, like, how is the cultural, racial attitudes of Democrats, have they changed over time?
Because it's almost
particularly,
like,
white Democrats.
Yeah.
In that sense, it almost gets the treatment of a scandal, where there are the regular issues that you know that the Democratic Party is going to talk about, and then each of the candidates is going to have their own weaknesses and scandals that bubble up, and then the other candidates glom onto and use those as talking points that are not necessarily enduring beyond whatever that one particular candidate's scandal is.
Right. And it's not that it's just a scandal. I mean, it's, there are concrete policy things to be discussed and, like, concrete American cultural things to be discussed within that context of racism. I don't think the Democratic Party as a political party wants to bring that up among its voters, particularly older white voters who they want to vote for them. Like, if I were a betting woman, I'd say maybe at some point someone says, okay, guys, like, let's cool it and just talk about healthcare, right? Because, like, we want to keep everyone happy-go-lucky. I don't know. That's just gaming it out. But, like, the idea of, yes, it's being treated right now as a scandal, not as a central policy thing. And that seems like a, maybe it should turn into a policy discussion and not just a hitting Biden on his historical record.
Yeah, not all through the lens of Biden.
And maybe that'll change. Like, maybe.
It probably will.
Yeah. I mean, Harris seems like the person best position to maybe do that. I don't know. I mean, you know, she has, you know, I got a presser this morning where her team said she now has the most endorsements from the Congressional Black Caucus. That could be a way for her to overcome, you know, she focuses on, like, more minority wealth issues, racial wealth issues. That could be a way to overcome her Kamala's a cop reputation, right? If that's a thing that they're worried about.
Well, I think you'll also see moments. I mean, we saw a little bit of this already, where, like, the discussion of whether crossing the border itself should be a criminal.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Should be criminalized. I think that will probably continue to be part of the conversation. Correct me if I'm wrong. Warren, I don't think, has released an immigration policy yet.
That's correct. The day before the debate, she came out and said that she thinks that crossing the border should be decriminalized, saying that she agrees basically with Julian Castro on that, but she didn't put out a full plan on immigration for people in the country already, for general asylum claim numbers and things like that.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird, for, if you think about it, for someone who's put out policies on so many things of, like, well, why not immigration, which is, like, such a central topic.
Well, you know what the answer to that question is, right?
Of course, yeah. It's like, she wants to wait, and it's like, it's probably smart.
Well, part of it, too, is that Trump is super unpopular, and so you're always in a good position if you're attacking what Trump is doing on immigration, whereas some of the positions of the base part of the Democratic Party are not, like, broadly popular across the country.
Well, that's why I was a little surprised by so many candidates, including Warren, signing up with Castro to decriminalizing crossing the border itself. Now, look, like, I don't want to wade into the policy of this too much because it's, like, outside my area of expertise. But my understanding of it is basically this is something that enabled the child separation policy of the Trump administration. But kind of outside of that, hasn't been a thing, really. I could get myself into trouble here. But I'm very surprised that so many Democrats have sort of jumped onto this when it seems so easily spun as open borders. Now, look, Trump has been and will say the Democrats are for open borders anyway, but it still feels to me like a potential point of vulnerability that these candidates.
I mean, I wonder how much of people saying that on stage was influenced by the fact that a lot of reporting had just come out about details of the detention center, which were sort of like Orwellian and horrifying in their nature. I mean, like, you know.
Well, and that photo as well.
Yes, the photo of the father and his drowned, I believe, two-year-old daughter. I mean, you know, just things like children aren't allowed to listen to music or write in journals, according to lawyers who are in these centers. So things that are really shocking to people. Children not allowed to take showers or brush their teeth, you know, whatever. And there was also this viral video of a Justice Department lawyer sort of making these arguments that showers and toothbrushes are not part of what the government should be providing. So I think it came at a particularly pitched point in this conversation. A lot of the Miami is obviously the large Latino population. All of these, I think most of these candidates went to visit a detention center in the area. So I think it was a particularly like emotionally pitched time for that. And I kind of wonder how much that played into people feeling like they're asked a question on the stage and they have to say, yes, I want to decriminalize it.
Yeah, we'll see how the conversation on immigration moves forward. And let's move on and talk about gerrymandering and the Supreme Court. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. Casper was created with one goal in mind: deliver a great night's sleep at an incredible value. This 4th of July holiday, experience Casper for yourself and transform your sleep. The Casper mattress combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all night, all summer. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. Casper also has free shipping and returns, so you'll be able to try out your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. This July 4th, Casper is getting sleepy for summer. Celebrate with 10% off any purchase with a mattress today through July 5th, 2019 by going to Casper.com now. That's Casper.com. Additional terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream with rates as low as 5.95 APR with autopay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, you can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. Right now, listeners can get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, we're back, and we're going to talk about the Supreme Court's ruling last Thursday on partisan gerrymandering. But before we do that, we got a whole bunch of listener feedback when we asked for metaphors to describe the presidential election. A lot of them were very funny, so we just wanted to share some of them with you before we go any further. I'll kick it off and then ask you guys what you thought. So I thought Julia's was pretty wise. She said the best metaphor for a presidential election is a regatta, because the political winds can take you through the finish line. And then the next one was from Peter. He said it was a decathlon because, one, it takes forever. Two, it's designed for men. I don't know if the decathlon, I guess it was. I don't really know what that means.
It's designed for men.
Favors those with wide but kind of shallow skill set. Has been around for centuries but looks way different nowadays. Is impractical and ends with everyone miserably tired.
We definitely just defended track and field athletes who are women.
I don't know if like the decathlon was actually designed for
well, all Olympic sports were originally designed for men. Yeah. But
I guess was the like, presidential election.
But like, it was originally designed for men. I don't know. I don't know if that metaphor is the best.
All right, what do you guys got?
My favorite was, or the most apt I thought was, someone said, climbing to base camp of Mount Everest. Once you're there, you still have to climb the actual mountain, winning the general election. I would kind of tweak it and say, like, actually, this is a bit dark, but like, given all the recent deaths on Mount Everest due to overcrowding. No, this is like for real, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like in some ways, like the most apt metaphor is like the primary is climbing to the summit. But then the general is also as deadly because people die on the way down because they're lines and stuff. Anyway, it's really dark, and I got obsessed with the Mount Everest story for a while because it's truly gruesome.
In this metaphor, the way down is what?
The general election. It's still treacherous.
Oh, okay.
But I think that the primary is climbing up because you're waiting in line. Because right now on Everest, people are waiting in line to get to.
That photo was amazing.
I mean, terrifying.
Okay, let me read out a couple. Wait, did you have more?
No, just the gruesome Mount Everest
just
one.
Just a really depressing one. Okay, Josiah the Carrot Stick said presidential elections are like Mario Kart races and battles. Bizarre and hectic, but still having some amount of strategy if you're actually trying. The debates are battles that factor into overall scoring. I haven't played Mario Kart in a while.
Oh, wait, actually, I have another one.
Go ahead.
Okay. Caitlin said it's like the Bachelor Bachelorette franchise. One, I have to do this because I watch the show.
Who's Luke P?
Luke B. Can I take a PSA for all the like teenage girls out listening to this podcast and also watching The Bachelorette? If a boy ever treats you or talks to you like Luke P does, get the out of there. That dude is crazy.
Wait, I don't, what?
Oh my gosh, he's what? He is like red flag central controlling boyfriend. Ugh. Oh my God. Anyway, Caitlin says it's like the Bachelor Bachelorette franchise. One, voters won't be able to identify by name until they're six total. Very true. What's the name of the really hot one? Tyler C? Yeah, Tyler C.
Yeah, there are a few.
Two, everyone is competing to be an archetype of a candidate. This season, there's a lot of Southern dudes. I'm just like talking about the Bachelorette now, not the presidential election. Three, most know they won't be chosen. They just want to be followers. Four, I need to be tipsy to watch. Caitlin.
That's pretty good.
Brava.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Wait, so the one where they said most know that they won't actually win, yes. They just want followers?
Yeah.
Or like they want to sell their book? Or
they
like
want to sell their book. They want Twitter followers. Good. They want to upsell. Yeah, I think that was very
like
good.
Like that musician from Nashville or whatever who's just playing music at every chance he gets.
Guys, he's a terrible singer. What's his name? Jed. Terrible singer.
All right, let's wrap this up.
All right, we got a really niche metaphor from 538 contributor Julia Zari. Knitting a sock, cuff down. God, I don't even know.
Please
what
make
means.
A video for us, Julia.
When you start out, you want the right number of stitches, not too many and not too few. Turning the heel is the convention. Once you get past that, it gets a little boring and you've got a ways to go. Narrowing the toe is the general election. As the end approaches, gets real, and there are so many ways to mess things up. If I knew anything about knitting a sock, I'm sure
knit,
I would find that.
But I only ever made scarves because
socks.
I couldn't do the, you have to buy like circular needles and like.
Okay, Noah emailed in to say that presidential elections are like the Westminster dog show. Candidates vie to break out of their group, eventually get crowned best in show. Then Noah, God bless him, broke every candidate into a real Westminster dog show group, working group, sporting group, hound group, non-sporting group, herding group, terrier group, toy group. So if you think you know where the candidates belong in those groups, let us know.
It's pretty good.
We got one. Best metaphor is a weekend at your in-laws. Goose.
No explanation, by the way, for the weekend at the in-laws.
It doesn't even make sense. 538 contributor Meredith Conroy. It's a beauty pageant. States' favored sons and daughters giving rehearsed answers to bad questions at debates, and there's a steady elimination of over the course of the campaign. That's pretty good. We also got a Miss America suggestion. Okay, I'll stop.
God, everyone used to watch Miss America.
Yeah, that went by the wayside.
Hungry really hippos.
Did. All right.
Does that work?
And with hungry hippos, we're going to move on to gerrymandering. The Supreme Court came out with two big decisions last week. The court ruled that for the time being, a citizenship question won't be added to the 2020 census. The decision went back to a lower court and could change in the future, though. The court also ruled decisively on partisan gerrymandering, saying that it's not an issue that's up to the courts to weigh in on and that the court will not put restrictions on the practice. As longtime listeners of the podcast know, I did a deep dive on gerrymandering back at the end of 2017, early 2018, called the Gerrymandering Project. Go check it out. But in any case, because of that and my familiarity with gerrymandering, I'm going to turn the hosting reins over to Claire and Micah for this segment, and y'all can ask me whatever questions
what
you want
wanting.
About yeah. this partisan Finally. Gerrymandering ruling.
Finally, control. I get to chuck chod this.
All right. The reins are yours. What do you
okay.
got?
Okay. Galen and Claire, raise your hand if you agree with... No.
It's a one-word answer. Excuse me. We just wanted one word.
Can we... Get rid of those questions.
Galen. What?
It's already off the rails. Jeez, that didn't take long.
Oh my God, there's so much pressure now. Galen, just maybe start off by telling us, what is the ruling? What does it say on the top lines part of it?
Primero, yo quería decir que si vamos a hablar de eso.
Sorry, what was the question?
What happened?
Tell us the nuts and bolts of what we need to know about this ruling.
Okay, so there were two cases, one out of North Carolina, one from Maryland. The North Carolina case was about Republican gerrymandering. The Maryland case was about Democratic gerrymandering. This is after last year the Supreme Court had sent similar gerrymandering case back to lower court for procedural reasons, essentially. And so this time we wanted to find out if they would actually rule on the meat of the issue. Is partisan gerrymandering unconstitutional? And what they said is it is simply not an issue that is up for the courts to decide. It is non-justiciable. It means it's a political issue. You know, they didn't say this is really great, although they did say that, like, you know, this practice goes back centuries and the Constitution doesn't do anything to block it. What they said is if you do want to change something about this practice, it has to be the legislatures or the voters in the states passing ballot initiatives or something like that. It is not up to the court to set the standard.
So did they say it was unconstitutional?
No. They said it's simply not something that is up for the courts to decide. The liberals on the court, you know, it was a 5-4 decision. So the liberals on the court, of course, said that it is unconstitutional. And the argument was that it violates either the First or 14th Amendment, freedom of association being the first. You can, you know, you're free to join your party without getting punished. And then the 14th Amendment is the Equal Protection Clause.
Are there other non-justiciable rulings that we can compare this to? Or is it, as Elena Kagan said, sort of unprecedented?
She said something along the lines of, this is the first time that the court has said that it's simply too hard to find a standard in, like, a clear violation of Americans' rights. You know, I am not a constitutional scholar in the sense that
I'm sure we'll get notes now.
Yeah. When past non-justiciable rulings held, I am sure, given the history of the court and that conservatives on the court have strong feelings about when the court should and shouldn't intervene, that there may be cases that are somewhat similar. I'm not familiar with them. But of course, that argument is a real one. If the court got involved in this case and said, this is where the line is, or, you know, this is too far, the Supreme Court would end up in a position where they're frequently
weighing in on these maps.
On these maps and deciding in favor of one party or another, ultimately, what should stay and what should go.
So federal courts, they're saying, can't weigh in on these issues. Can state courts?
And that is the question of the hour, right? Yeah, state courts still can, and I'm sure they will, because reformers, activists who want to see partisan gerrymandering go by the wayside have already pursued this through state courts, you know, using state constitutions in order to make their arguments. The first successful case like this was in Pennsylvania, where the map got thrown out, redrawn before the 2018 election. It gave Democrats seats there, and Republicans in Pennsylvania asked the Supreme Court to weigh in and block the state Supreme Court from mandating this new map. The Supreme Court said, no, that's based on your own state constitution. You know, y'all figure out what you want to do with that state constitution.
It's a real states' rights,
yeah,
bread and butter issue.
And the other factor here, right, is that state constitutions do not directly mimic the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
And 26 states have provisions, some type of provision that describes free and open or free and equal elections that is not in the federal constitution. And so reformers are trying to use that language in some of the constitutions and say, hey, this protects people, you know, from the harm of partisan gerrymandering, and you should rule thus.
So this basically means that, well, can I draw a comparison here to abortion law right now in the United States, where blue states might have different abortion laws, more abortion clinics are open in blue states versus red states. Is there going to be a similar sort of partisan breakdown where blue states are going to be less gerrymandered and red states are going to be more gerrymandered? Or is everyone going to be super gerrymandered now because of this ruling that basically says, go hog wild, we're not going to rule on this?
So it's definitely the case that the country will just have a patchwork of different redistricting laws. That has already been the case because states have their own laws on the books, and some have had ballot initiatives passed that have forced the states to create independent redistricting commissions. There are 8 states that have redistricting commissions on both the state legislative and congressional level. Of course, in a place like Pennsylvania, you now have the constitution of the state interpreted to mean that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional in the state. So yes, when it comes to the state courts, the state Supreme Courts, how these rulings go will probably depend in large part on whether or not there are liberal majorities on those state courts. So for, you know, fans of the judiciary not becoming politicized, it may not, I guess, become politicized on the Supreme Court level and that they're judging every map that gets passed into law by state legislatures. But now in potentially 26 states or however many states, reformers will bring these cases and state Supreme Courts will have to still make these decisions on a state by state level.
It's sort of become this Democratic Party line to say, you know, one of the reasons why we've been losing elections is because maps are super gerrymandered against us. But don't Democrats also sometimes have advantages when it comes to gerrymandering? Like, isn't there a flip side to all of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Democrats have a long history of gerrymandering, particularly in the South. Most recently, they obviously gerrymandered Maryland, which is what gave John Delaney, current candidate for president, the opportunity to win in the district that he won in Maryland. Illinois is also gerrymandered. The reason that Republicans have a significant advantage in the current decade is because they did so well in 2010, mm-hmm. won a lot of state legislative seats, and therefore enacted their partisan gerrymanders when it came time to redistrict in 2011. Now, Democrats seem to be allying themselves with more the academic reformers who just say that, and good governance groups who say that partisan gerrymandering is wrong. They obviously have good reason to in this decade because they're upset about the consequences of the 2011 redistricting cycle. We will see if that remains to be the case in the new redistricting cycle. Right. Say they do really well in 2020 in state legislative races. Then they'll have an opportunity to make a decision. They can say, we want to pass a law preventing partisan gerrymandering in our state in perpetuity. Or they can say, hey, y'all did it to us last decade. We're going to do it now.
Any predictions on which way they'll go?
Probably different states will do things differently. Yeah. I think that there are activists and reformers now in a bunch of states who are so upset about the past decade that they'll maybe put pressure on Democrats, even if they're in the majority in the state legislature, to pass those laws. But, you know, also, at the end of the day, there are going to be activists who also just want to win. Look, Maryland and Illinois did it. Like, there's definitely no reason to believe that once Democrats are in power, they won't do it.
Are there any states that we should be watching? So red states that might flip blue where we could see the consequences of this ruling carried out, i.e. Democrats having the chance to gerrymander and they kind of have to make this moral civic choice of do we partisan gerrymander or do we pass laws that ensure, you know, good governance or more equal nonpartisan gerrymandering.
So you'll definitely have to get back to me after the 2020 election, and then I'll have a better sense of where the trifectas are. But something that is important to keep in mind in all of this is that the way that you have the opportunity to enact a kind of uncompromising partisan gerrymander is generally if you have a trifecta. You're in control of both chambers of the state legislature and the governorship. One thing that could happen in 2020 that changes the scene a bit is that you have fewer trifectas. So say, I mean, we already know that Wisconsin is likely to be an example. So there's now a Democratic governor. Both chambers of the legislature are still controlled by Republicans. But in 2021, Tony Evers, the current governor of Wisconsin, will still be the governor. And so even if the legislature remains Republican, it'll be split, and therefore the governor won't necessarily sign potentially partisan gerrymandered maps that Republican lawmakers put forward. Then it will go to the state Supreme Court if they can't make up their minds. And then the state Supreme Court will, which currently has a conservative majority, will kind of be deciding how the lines get drawn probably. But there are also maybe cases where the Republicans and Democrats can come to some kind of agreement about what the maps should look like. So there are a couple reasons that the maps in the next decade will not be as gerrymandered, even though the Supreme Court has now said it's not up to us to block it. And those reasons are, one, more ballot initiatives. Activists have brought ballot initiatives most recently in places like Michigan. A constitutional amendment was passed in Ohio. There was another ballot initiative in Missouri, Utah, the list goes on. So there's those initiatives that put in place independent redistricting commissions. There is the possibility for split control of state government. There is also the possibility of lawsuits in state courts that prevent partisan gerrymandering. So, you know, we'll see. I think a lot of people hearing this case were like, oh no, now things are going to get like crazy out of hand. Everyone's going to draw like wildly gerrymandered maps. That will still probably be the case in some states, mm-hmm. but it's not going to be like overnight one of the two most extreme options in favor of Democrats or Republicans.
Do you, Galen or Claire, if I'm a citizen of this country,
Are you not?
Who cares about, I don't have to answer that. Who cares about good government and sort of like, let's say, proportional representation.
Which is not in the Constitution, Micah.
Okay. Well, let's just say I find that
attractive goal.
A fair goal. Where should gerrymandering rank on my like list of concerns? So, you know, we've seen a lot of best practices in election proposals making their way around the conversation. You know, there's like stuff like voter ID laws. There's stuff like automatic voter registration. There's stuff like lowering the age which you can vote, or making election day a national holiday, or even stuff like getting rid of the filibuster, or, you know, anyway, how much should I care about gerrymandering?
That's a complicated question. I mean, one thing to keep in mind for sure is when you're looking at Congress, obviously the Senate cannot be gerrymandered. So if you're a Democrat who is upset about partisan gerrymandering, well, you currently control the House, the chamber where partisan gerrymandering right. takes its toll. You don't control the Senate, and you may not after 2020 either. So it's important to keep in mind that, one, getting rid of partisan gerrymandering would make changes to the House, not the Senate. Of course, on the state legislative level, it makes a lot of difference, and that is where a lot of legislation is getting yeah. passed the most quickly. So that's pretty significant. It's hard to like say, if you're just looking at the outcome of an election, how much does partisan gerrymandering change the outcomes versus people who may not have voted because of voter ID, or people who may not have become interested in the process because there was not automatic voter registration? I couldn't give you that answer. There are areas where partisan gerrymandering makes a significant difference. There are obviously areas where it makes no difference at all, but people just generally feel like partisan gerrymandering is rigging the system and are therefore yeah. upset about it, even if it is not the like direct cause of something that you don't like.
It's like a symbolic.
Sometimes. Yeah. Right. Like we often talk about partisan gerrymandering is not necessarily responsible for partisan polarization. It just gets the blame for yeah. partisan polarization when there are many other things going on there too.
Galen, you know a lot about this. And listeners, if you are confused by gerrymandering or want to know more, I really highly recommend listening to Galen's, what was it, 6-part podcast?
Yeah, I think it was 6 parts.
The Gerrymandering Project. It is easy listening on your ears to explain a very complicated issue. And I think that also, you know, we have some writing up on the site that I would really encourage people to go check it out. Thank you so much, Galen.
Thank you. I guess that's it. I'm taking back the reins. And also, that means this is like it. We're not covering partisan gerrymandering at the Supreme Court again. It is case closed. Never come back to us again.
Is that true?
Racial gerrymandering is still definitely going to be at the Supreme Court. Maybe someday, if there is a liberal majority, they'll try to get this decision overturned. Like, I wouldn't hold your breath, but, you know, who knows? Anyway, let's move on to talk about the new sexual assault allegation against President Trump. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs flexible workspaces for businesses of all sizes and industries. WeWork spaces are designed to maximize workplace efficiency, employee effectiveness, team collaboration, and creativity. It's the perfect solution for medium, large, and enterprise businesses that intend to expand into new cities and continents with ease. Looking for an office with a view of Lima, London, Melbourne, or Mumbai? WeWork now has over 400 locations in 100 different cities worldwide. Membership plans are completely flexible, and workspaces are designed to grow with your team. WeWork's floor mapping technology is used to build out custom private floors for larger teams, perfectly designed to fit your business's continuously evolving needs. WeWork pays special attention to the culture and energy in each of their locations, designed to foster amazing partnerships and collaborations both within teams and across companies. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you or learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. Today's podcast is also brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. And the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources. And that hurts the bottom line. NetSuite by Oracle is the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time and money by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/538. That's netsuite.com/538 to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. That's netsuite.com/538. We're back, and a week and a half ago, author E. Jean Carroll recounted that Trump raped her in a dressing room in the 1990s. Carol's account got limited attention, including from us. We didn't talk about it on last Monday's show. It also did not make the front page of the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, or Chicago Tribune the day after the accusation came out. So let's talk about the level of media attention Carol received, and in general, what effect sexual assault accusations have had on President Trump. So first, why did this get such limited coverage? You might otherwise expect wall-to-wall coverage of a rape accusation against a sitting president.
I think it's wrong that it didn't get the amount of coverage that it did, but I think it probably is for a couple reasons. One, it came in the form of a book excerpt in a magazine, and the way that E. Jean Carroll, who, by the way, has been for a long time been an advice columnist at Elle Magazine, and actually just aside from her writing in this, which is quite powerful and about sexual assault, she's sort of like a delightfully impish writer who I've loved for a long time in her advice column. So I would encourage people to check out that kind of writing that she does.
Yeah.
But her essay was about basically men over the course of her lifetime, starting when she was very young, who have sexually assaulted her. And Trump was the last, and she sort of tells the details of the rape. But it came in this kind of nuanced, essayistic form, right? It kind of wasn't what we're used to in the era of Me Too, which is like the hard reporting kind of thing. And she does have in it, you know, I told two friends at the time contemporaneously, they don't want their names to be out there. So I think that's reason number one, is just the format that it came in. Two, I think probably has something to do with, I don't know how to say this, other than like an odd media snobbery about maybe the New York Times didn't want to put it on the cover because the essay had been published in New York Magazine and it wasn't reported by one of their reporters. It was a book excerpt that E. Jean Carroll had done, although I know New York has fact checkers, all that stuff, so I'm sure it was fact checked. But I'm sure it had something to do with that competition. And also, finally, there have been a lot of accusations like this against the president. This is the most serious one because it involves rape. But I think it was sort of a swirl of unfortunate factors that made it an undercovered thing. And we can talk about that more. But
yeah, the last one in particular, I think, the media is set up to cover new things. And this was new, but thematically, I think a lot of journalists, again, including us here, lump this in with, you know, the at least 22 other sexual misconduct allegations against Trump. I mean, even, you know, to be honest about it, I was sort of thinking about, okay, what are we going to talk about on the show today? It's like, at least as it regards to Trump, finding something new to say on it is sort of difficult. I mean, we've talked about this many times. It's a flaw in the way the media is set up.
The one thing I will add is I do think it got a little more, I would say, hard news attention after the New York Times reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story, after they basically hard news reported it out, right? So they got in touch with E. Jean Carroll and the two women whom she had told, and they kind of put them on the record, which I think was a good journalistic thing to do by the New York Times. I think that added to the story to like have those women all out there on the record, and it basically made, I guess, for lack of a better phrasing, like digestible in a shorter newspaper context rather than reading a, you know, 4,000 word essay, which, by the way, is worth reading. It's like a very,
right.
It's actually tells you a lot about the way America treats American women and like men treat women and the way that older women in particular think about sexual assaults that have happened to over the course of their lifetime, which is to say they put it in a different category, right? That one of the interesting things about, I think, E. Jean Carroll's story, and she is a contemporary of Donald Trump, right, is that she does not call it a rape. She sets these things that have happened to her in her life in sort of bad, she calls them despicable men, hideous men, bad things that have happened to her, but she kind of has trouble like calling it sexual assault. And I think if you talk to women of a certain age, they don't think of it in the same way, which is troubling for other reasons. But I do think it was unfortunate that it kind of got lost in this. It fit in the narrative of Donald Trump stories. And because of that, it didn't get a lot of attention. And we can talk about how that maybe goes against the curve of how scandals usually play out.
Yeah, it's interesting because in particular what broke down, like the way a lot of stories blow up and seem to have weight in our like fractured media environment is, okay, news breaks, then there's a, everybody reports on the news, right? And then there's like second day takes, one level out, you know, let's find a fresh angle on this, or new details emerge. And then there's like the third day take, where then you start to see like think pieces on it, and then the, well, actually pieces on it. And the problem here is that I think for a lot of the media, they've already written those pieces on this topic. At least that's what they think. And so it short circuits the normal media conversation that happens with a story like this, right? Where it's like, normally, okay, this allegation comes out, then you have people trying to match a story, reporting out more details on the story. Some of that happened here, right? But then that next level where, like, frankly, we're writing about it from our particular view on things. Yeah.
I hear that. But then when we've talked about scandals in the past on the show, the formula that we've described is that when a scandal sticks, it's usually because it plays into a narrative that has already been developed. Think of Hillary Clinton and the emails, right? That stuck and, you know, new reporting came out and that got reported on and developed further and basically created this enduring narrative that, you know, when WikiLeaks came out, when the Comey letter came out, blah, 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 it was all rehashed. So why in this case is it not that, oh, this plays into a previous narrative, all the more reason to investigate further and give information to the public? Let me give you the stat, by the way. HuffPo YouGov did a survey at the end of June, and it said 53% of Americans hadn't heard anything about these allegations. So when people make the claim that Trump is Teflon and things don't affect him, well, part of the reason that Americans find out about what is going on is through the media. And if the media doesn't cover it, then they're not going to know.
No, but the conception about Trump that this plays into is that he doesn't respect women, that he's assaulted women, and that he's unethical at core. The problem is, and again, I want to be clear, I'm like trying to explain why this hasn't gotten more coverage. I'm not saying this is right.
Yeah, exactly.
The problem is, with the email, or normally when we say, hey, a scandal has legs when it plays into an existing narrative, the scandal is newer than this is being treated by the media. In other words, okay, I'm running for office and I have a reputation as someone who is shady with business. Maybe that's because, you know, 5 years ago there was a story about me taking bribes or something, right? Then a story comes out that I've invested in such and such company, which I, you know, have some power over, blah, blah, blah. That's like a categorically new type of scandal that plays into an existing narrative. In this case, I think in the media, it's almost as if it's the same scandal over and over and over again. Sure, it's playing into an existing narrative.
Well, let me also say,
but it's of the same category.
It's a particular kind of scandal, which is to say it's about rape, it's about sexual assault, and there's not usually a paper trail for that. It is he said, she said, and Trump can parry the allegations by saying, I never did it. I don't know her.
She's not my type.
She's not my type, which is what he said. I didn't know her, which is what he said. There's a picture of him and E.G. Carroll in around the same era. But allegations like this are he said, she said. And you can convince some of the people that you didn't do it. You didn't assault her. You didn't rape her. Whatever. I should say, we can also discuss, I mean, electorally, this could be having consequences. I mean, I'm going to bring in the gender gap, which is to say that in 2016, after many of these allegations came to light, there was the biggest gender gap that we've seen in the country in a presidential election. So that means there was a 22-point gender gap. What that means is men voted for Republicans by a net of 12 points. Women voted for Democrats by a net of 10 points. And that only increased in the 2018 midterm. So there was a 23-point gender gap. So it went up a point. And I believe among white women, this sort of interesting sticky group in 2016, which voted for Republicans in 2016, they split between Republicans and Democrats in 2018. So that's surely an accumulation of lots of factors. But, I mean, Trump is the head of the Republican Party. Trump has a certain reputation of at best boorishness, at worst criminality when it comes to his treatment of women. And I am sure that that is something that women voters are thinking about.
Not only women voters. I mean, we talk about this all the time, but like Trump's approval rating right now is way worse than it should be if you look at the economy.
Right.
And so how do you explain that? I certainly think this is one of the ways you explain that. You know, if you look at polls of whether people believe these allegations against him, usually the polls are worded, like the YouGov poll was worded, a number of women have accused Donald Trump of sexual harassment or sexual assault. A plurality of respondents say they are generally credible. 41%, 29% say not credible, and 31% say they're not sure or haven't heard enough. So one, that so many say not sure, haven't heard enough, both speaks to the problems with the media coverage, but also to your point, Claire, about the lack of a paper trail. But like, let's be clear, a plurality say they're generally credible. Now, there is a big partisan split on it. Partisanship tends to override gender, actually, in terms of what people think. So women who voted for Trump are less likely than men who supported Trump to say the accusations are not credible. But they're way, way, way closer to Trump-supporting men than to Democrats.
Right. This was our big thing
after
the Access Hollywood tape in particular, when everyone thought, oh my gosh, this is going to change everything. And then you saw that Republican women were sticking with him.
I mean, but then there's also an underlying question of, is Trump causing some women to either become unaffiliated or identify as Democrats in these polls? I mean, I don't know. Maybe we don't have an answer to that question. But when I was down in Texas leading up to the midterms in 2018, you know, the Republican Party was saying part of the reason we may not win this district, or our biggest challenge in this district, is that women aren't voting for us, especially college educated women aren't going to vote for us.
Which is a long term trend in the Republican Party, sort of losing women.
Yeah.
But the idea that you lose this kind of critical demographic of, yes, college educated white women, that's an important swing group now. And they're sort of, they've been steadily migrating, it looks like, to the Democratic side. So this is a problem for Republicans that preceded Trump, but perhaps has been exacerbated by Trump.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to look at it. It's a real problem. I think there was this perception on the left of like, how could any woman vote for Trump? And that's obviously not true. Lots of women voted for Trump. But that doesn't mean it's not a huge problem for Trump and Republicans. Not only these stories of sexual assault and harassment on Trump's part, but also just the general perception that the GOP is out of step with women-specific issues that aren't really specific to women, but are at least framed that way.
I mean, the old example was, quote, legitimate rape. So there was a sort of disastrous 2012 legitimate rape comments by Todd Akin that just really did quite a lot to make Republicans as a whole look wildly out of touch with, quote unquote, women's issues. Obviously, rape is not a woman's issue. It's a reputational problem that Republicans have struggled with for a long time.
Yeah. And by the way, if you look at the Republican Party, it's not, you know, this is not a Trump specific thing. Claire mentioned this earlier. You know, Perry wrote this big piece for us a few months ago, or maybe it was longer than that. The Republican Party does not elect a lot of women, and that's putting it kindly. You know, if you look at the kind of progress that has been made towards gender parity in Congress, it's basically all on the Democratic side.
Right, the year of the woman
was all Democrats.
Pretty much all Democrats, yeah.
And why the GOP doesn't elect more women is a complicated question, and Perry sort of spends a lot of time trying to unpack why and does a lot of reporting, and probably we don't have time to get into it here. But I think that's kind of the root cause of a lot of this. You know, you get these like moments where a Senate subcommittee on women's health will be paneled by all white men, right? I don't know. I've taken off track here, but it's a problem for the party.
Yeah. Before we do start to wrap up, I wanted to add to what you said earlier, Claire, in that gender gap in 2016 was 22 points. It was 23 points in 2018. But underlying that is a maybe even crazier data point, which is that, so we're just measuring the difference between men and women. But in 2016, men were plus 12 Republican. In 2018, they were plus 4 Republican. So they moved 8 points. But the gender gap was still larger in 2018. So women went from plus 10 Democratic to plus 19 Democratic, meaning that the gender gap was still larger, even though men were almost even, right? So I think Republican strategists looking at that number, that makes them feel pretty uncomfortable. Like, you can have a large gender gap if you're still way overperforming with men, but when you're still doing so poorly with women, that becomes untenable, right? As we saw in 2018. So in conclusion, are we saying that even though people may think that Trump is Teflon and these things don't affect him, that
no,
they do.
They have.
Yeah, I think that it's like, what's the cumulative long-term effect of this? What is the 2020 effect of this? What is the building reputational negative pull potentially on Trump in 2020 with critical swing voters, i.e. college-educated white women?
Yeah.
You know, and that's, and not to single out a demographic group, but that is a group that Republicans care a lot about, that Democrats are really seeing ways to make inroads with.
If you were trying to imagine a world where Trump's approval rating was more in line with how good the economy is doing, you would have to imagine a world where Trump behaves a little more normally day to day. And I think you'd have to imagine a world where the, about 24 women haven't accused the president of sexual misconduct. That is a big part. It has to be to explain why Trump is so underperforming where he, quote unquote, should be. So he's not Teflon.
All right. Well, I think that is a wrap for today. Thank you, guys. Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
We had a pretty meaty show, even though
we're a smaller
cast today.
Yeah.
More time to... it felt like we had more time to talk today.
Really? I wonder why that might be. Anyway, my name is Galen Druk. Our intern, Jake Arlo, is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.